Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of clinical experience in patient-centered care. Our conversation today is on the connection between the mind and the heart. And I'm joined by Dr. Jonathan Fisher, a cardiologist, certified mindfulness teacher, and well-being and resiliency leader supporting a team of 38,000 people. He's also the founder of Mind Heart Now LLC, delivering keynotes and workshops on mindfulness, stress mastery, total well-being, and heart-centered leadership for teams and organizations globally, including IBM, Bank of America, IE Business School in Madrid, and the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, among many others. He co-founded the Ending Clinician Burnout Global Community and organized the world's first global summit dedicated to ending clinician burnout with over 1,000 participants from 43 countries. Dr. Fisher completed his medical training at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City and Harvard University. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Sharon, it's so good to talk with you again. I'm really excited for our chat.
I am too. Backstory for all of our listeners, we went to the same residency program, finished about a year apart, so it's always nice to reconnect. Jonathan, you trained as a cardiologist, and I'm very interested in your path to the heart and the mind. One of the sentences that I saw on your website that really just grabbed me was, "I took care of 20,000 other hearts before taking care of my own." So tell me how you've navigated to the mind and the heart.
Sharon, it was the good old days when we were up in Boston, and I think fondly of them. If I could go back and maybe spend a day with the residents that was us, there were some things that I'd like to share. The things that maybe would have helped me, especially thinking back, there were days when a patient would get sick or would die, and I would find myself crying in the stairwell with no one by my side. And I wasn't prepared for the toll, the emotional and spiritual toll that becoming a medical doctor would take on me. And so the quest that I've been on in the last 20 years is to find out what was missing and essentially write a textbook, not just for people in healthcare, but for patients who are struggling with all aspects of the heart. For me, it started in suburban New Jersey. My dad was the town doctor. We have this old sycamore tree in front of our house. It's still there. My dad is still living there. He's going to be 98 in 2 months. We're going to see him next week.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. And he was this old-timey suburban town doctor. He was the doctor for a town of 25,000. And actually, if you can see that there, that was one of his first doctor's bags. It's the old leather bag from the 1930s. And he would take it in the station wagon. And one by one, my six older brothers and sisters would go on house calls with him. So it was a really kind of a Norman Rockwell thing. He practiced out of our basement and people would walk in the front door. So I grew up seeing medicine firsthand. And there was still something missing from the curriculum. At the same time as I was thinking about how am I going to get straight A's and how am I going to please everybody around me and make mom and dad proud, there wasn't so much about who am I? What do I want? What are all these feelings that are happening inside of me that I'm sort of ignoring or shunning away and stuffing down? And so my naturally cerebral kind of nerdy personality got me a long way. And it left me with a sense of feeling separate from other people. Like I was stuck in my head. I had a very active mind and I was always making up stories and trying to explain things. And that active mind was keeping me isolated and really separate. And I found myself pretty lonely, beginning later in high school and even throughout college, which led to, and I didn't know it was at the time, but led to depression. And at least in my family and the way I grew up, it wasn't okay to talk about being depressed or feeling depressed or even admitting to anxiety or nervousness, because I come from this high-achieving family, and we just didn't talk about these things. And so I had this huge imposter syndrome when I got to Harvard. And now, later on, I find out I'm not the only one.
I think a lot of our residency classmates would identify with that.
I hope so. I hope so. I think we should just share a little more openly, because it would take some of the pressure off the current medical students and current residents, because bottling that up for so many years is what eventually led me to not only burnout as a cardiologist. I mean, I was barreling down the hall of my clinic just not even 10 years ago and ignoring my staff and trying to get from one patient to another as fast as possible. I was miserable. And I got a review one year. The office manager brought me in. And remember, I was seeing 2,000 to 3,000 patients a year. I was on call overnight every fourth night, exhausted. And the feedback was, nobody likes to work with you.
Oh, goodness.
And that's the last thing in the world I wanted to hear. And that was a real reckoning for me to say, how did I become this person? Was it just the toxic healthcare system? Was it what's driving all the burnout? Or were there some things that I was ignoring in my life? And it turns out it was more of the latter. It was more not being fully honest with myself about some of the challenges I was facing. Here's a heart doctor who's stuck in his brain, and the brain is just giving him lots of anxiety and some depression. And so I decided to make it my life's mission to help my patients. I was realizing, and you know this as a lifestyle medicine expert, that at least 60 to 70% of our patients' symptoms and conditions, and those with chronic disease, have some layer of either emotional, unresolved feelings, some lack of social connection, or something broader than that, some lack of spiritual connection. And it really became interesting for me to research this connection between our thoughts and our feelings and our beliefs and our physiology, the physical heart. And that was what got me started about 15 years ago.
Oh, and I think a lot of people from really any field can relate to that, because some of it is the process. You know, you are told what to do in school, then you are told what to do in graduate school, and you start working for an employer and you're told what to do, and stopping to actually ask the question, what do I want? You know, that difference between the cerebral and the heart that you mentioned. I think, you know, a lot of people actually go many years into adulthood without asking those questions. So I think a lot of people can relate. When you made that connection and got that feedback, what did you do to start making changes?
When I first made the connection that I needed to do a lot of inner work in order to start showing up for my patients as a real heart doctor, not a technician, not just somebody who had a lot of knowledge and knew all the medicines, but somebody who could really listen and recognize their humanity, and someone who could realize that healing happens in that space between the provider and the clinician and the doctor and the nurse and the patient. It doesn't happen from a blood test, and it doesn't happen from a scan. And in order to do that, I knew I had to find out. I needed to go to another medical school, essentially recreate my whole education, the parallel education that was missing. And it started, fortunately, with going to therapy. I remember, Sharon, when I was a resident at the Brigham, I finally was given the courage by my sister and best friend, Andrea, who saw how much I was suffering. I was just exhausted and I was lonely. And she said, Jonathan, can you just be kind to yourself? Be kind to yourself. This is before the whole movement in self-compassion was happening. This is now 20 years ago plus. And she was the one who gave me courage to seek help and go to therapy. And that's not a cool thing to admit. And so I did not want you or any of my other co-residents to see me going to a shrink. And so I, in the winter in Boston, I would bring an overcoat and I would fold up the collars so that people wouldn't see me in profile going into the doctor's office. That's what began it. And I spent a year really looking at my childhood, looking at many beliefs I had about my role in the world and the beliefs that I was holding on to and the patterns of behavior that were keeping me separate from what I really wanted to experience in my life, which was just love and affection and joy. And that's what started the path. And the second piece of the path was a good friend. I was at her brother's funeral. I had just lost my sister, Andrea, the same sister who had helped me seek therapy. She was diagnosed.
So sorry.
Thank you. She was diagnosed with a brain tumor that was inoperable when she was in her 40s. And so I was in my grief and my friend was in her grief. And she said, here's a book. And it was by a Buddhist nun of all things, someone named Pema Chodron. And the book is called When Things Fall Apart. And I said, I don't know what's in there, but that's what life feels like right now. I was pretending to be this smart, you know, Harvard resident and trying to pretend like I knew everything, and it wasn't getting me where I needed to go. And I had just lost my sister. And in this book, she said, your suffering will only begin to disappear when you can abandon all hope that there's anywhere to hide.
Oh, that's powerful.
So I decided then and there that I was going to stop hiding from what was happening inside of me. I was going to take a look at my emotions, at my habits of behavior. And that led me down the path of meditation, mindfulness, positive psychology as a framework for living a good and happy life, which is what I wanted, as well as mind-body practices like yoga and tai chi, qigong, etc. And one thing led to another. I became a certified teacher. I went to Oxford in the UK to get training in how to share this. And now I share it with thousands of healthcare workers in my own system and with all of my patients at the end of each visit.
Wow, that's amazing. And Jonathan, the heart-mind connection. So can you explain the connection?
The explanation goes back 3,000 years. As a cardiologist, we look at scientists through history, like Galen, who was a Roman doctor. He's one of the early doctors, and he did dissections, and he was the first to discover that the heart was actually pumping blood. Before we did cadaveric exploration, he did it on animals. We didn't know that. And so most spiritual traditions from around the world actually believe that the heart was the source of our emotions. Aristotle believed it too. And so there once was a time when we kind of knew that emotions had something to do with the heart itself. And I think as modern cardiology has evolved through dissections and modern imaging, and as modern neuroscience and neural discoveries have evolved and psychology has evolved over the last 150 years, there's been this gradual separation where everything has its corner, like in a boxing match. The heart sits over here in the chest and the brain sits over there in the cranium. And what we now know, thanks to research beginning around 60, 70 years ago, is that there are many pathways, and we can dive into these, that communicate real time, moment by moment, what's happening in the brain with what's happening in the heart. And it's a bi-directional pathway. In fact, there's possibly more information coming from the heart itself feeding into the brain than in the other direction. And so we have this now with imaging studies. A lot of it is based on mind training and what happens to the heart during certain mental training activities like meditation, tai chi, yoga. Some of it is a new cross-pollination between the field of positive psychology and cardiology. Thousands of research papers now showing that positive psychology, in other words, the science of mental and emotional flourishing, directly supports our physical health. And it's actually a pillar of lifestyle medicine, not just stress management. I would go much further than managing stress. I would say living a flourishing full life has plenty of data now, which is what I bring to my patients. And I try to bring this to my colleagues, whether we're talking about emotions of love, experience of empathy, compassion, awe, gratitude, there is a literature now showing improved cardiovascular health with these. And it's by way of three broad mechanisms, which we can certainly discuss.
Absolutely. And the mind-heart connection, the heart has its own nervous system, really, right? Like there's literally a connection that lends credence to this historical perspective that emotions stem from the heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And can you explain that more? You mentioned that there are more inputs, you know, vagal inputs from the heart to the head.
Exactly.
But can you explain that connection? Because I think intuitively when, you know, we say, oh, we love someone, we always point to our heart. But of course, the heart is an organ. And how do we come about thinking that we hold emotions in this organ?
There's two parts to that. One is, why do we feel our emotions in our chest and our heart? And the second is, how are the mind and heart connected? How do they communicate with each other? The first one is obvious and it's easy, but we don't think about it. The reason for this is that the brain does not feel. If you're saying something warm to me or you're smiling at me and I'm feeling really good, I'm not having a feeling in my left prefrontal cortex right now. There's no sensation that's there. There's information, there's signaling that's happening. What I am experiencing, though, is in my body. And this is how we evolved over millions of years. Despite what I was taught as a kid, where the intellect and your brain capacity is all you need, we actually evolved to need our feelings to direct us towards action. And so the heart, just like the gut, we can have a gut feeling, we can have a heart feeling, we can feel our spine tingle, our hair can stand on end, piloerection. These are all actual physically palpable experiences. And there was a wonderful study done in Finland looking at cultures around the world. And what they did was they had people experience the most common emotions, whether it was love, joy, anger. And they asked everyone to draw a map of their body, literally a heat map of their body, while they're experiencing, you use the example of love. And what was interesting about this study is they found a remarkable agreement, whether you were in East Asia or America or in Europe, of exactly feeling the same thing in the same place in the body. Each emotion has its own signature, which kind of guides us towards action. And the heart, I would say, is the number one player. You know, whether we're feeling the racing pounding of fear or the warm kind of slowing easefulness of a gentle sunset that we're watching, the heart is kind of like the weather vane for the body. And then that's what we call, now we're talking about emotions. Emotions begin as emotions. It's a primary experience of just a gut reaction that we're wired for. And then these signals travel to the brain, many of them through the vagus nerve, others through sensory inputs. And the brain then interprets whatever sensations are happening. There's a good science now that also shows many of our symptoms happen because the brain misinterprets that initial signal, because we're living so separated from our own bodies, from our own hearts, we get the signals wrong. We think we're having a heart attack when we're really excited to meet somebody. And so there are signals to the brain. Then the brain decodes them, makes up some story about what's going on. And then there are three pathways by which this cycle then escalates. So an emotion, a feeling in the body, then becomes an emotion in the mind based on the story. And what happens then is our mind changes. So we have neurochemicals that are released. So whether it's the amygdala itself is a central part of the brain, the amygdala is responsible for our initial fight or flight reaction. There's a flood of epinephrine, dopamine, and then there's cortisol that's released. So in the brain, there's this emotion neurochemical pathway that happens. The second of the three sort of parallel pathways that happen in an instant when we're having a feeling happens in the body itself. So the purpose of these chemicals in the brain is to move the body towards either evasive action or towards some resource. And so our heart then quickens. Our lungs breathe faster. Our pupils may dilate or constrict. We begin to perspire. Our stomach acid increases or decreases depending on our level of stress. And then finally, sort of what I think is the most important of these three links between the mind and the heart, our behavior changes. That's the point of emotions. And so we start to behave in ways that are either life-affirming, health-supporting behaviors, or often if we're feeling a contracted emotion, which I call a heart-breaking emotion, over periods of time, we start to behave in ways that are what we call maladaptive. We start to behave in ways that separate us from other people, that increase our loneliness just when we might need social support, that cause us to comfort eat, to sit on the couch, to binge watch Netflix. And so these are the three pathways where the mind speaks to the body and our behavior, and the heart itself, all the while through its own neural network, is communicating directly back to the brain.
So in terms of influencing these patterns, you know, the inputs that we're sending to our brain are obviously things that we want to be more aware of and really alter, right, to change the outcomes. What are practices that a person can do to help these communications?
Fortunately, we have a lot of ways into this circuit, and there's no right way. You could start with anything. It kind of depends on what your personal preference is, what your history is, and how much time you have. My general first guidance would be not to do what we've already done when we're stressed out. So if I'm stressed out about a situation, I start to think about it and kind of play chess in my mind. And that's one strategy, right, to deal with stress. But for me, it's usually not one that leads me to a calm, clear, wise place. And so for me, the recommendation is counterintuitive for a lot of people when they first start, which is to somehow get out of the thinking mind. The thinking mind is great, and we venerate the brain, and we think it's got everything correct, but it's wrong a lot of the time. And so my first recommendation is just to get away from the thoughts and into the body somehow, and you can take your pick how you do that. A simple, deep breath that's diaphragmatic, so activating the diaphragm, breathing into the belly, not in the chest like we often do, but into the belly activates the vagus nerve, especially when we exaggerate the exhale. That's key. So a deep inhale, exaggerated exhale, even one or two of those immediately activates that vagus nerve that we were talking about, which by feedback slows our heart rate, lowers our blood pressure, and begins to open us towards wiser thinking, I guess I would say. So one is just a deep breath. For me, yoga, if someone has more time, talking about getting into our feelings and moving away from the bias towards the thinking, yoga is really one of the best practices along with Tai Chi. And for people who don't want to go that woo-woo, I would say take a walk, go for a run, ride a bicycle. But notice the tendency when we're exercising to do it in our typical overachiever's way, where while we're walking, we're thinking about what am I going to make for dinner and when am I going to do the laundry, these kinds of things. Instead, practice mindfully moving. So moving where we're not thinking about our life. Instead, just feel the experience itself, whether that's the breeze on your skin, the warmth of the sun on your face, the sensations in your body, good or bad. That would be how I would start, Sharon, would be to just give the mind a rest and find some practice that gets you into the body, into this moment.
And obviously, stress is something a lot of people can relate to, so that's very helpful. But there's so much beyond stresses and emotion that inputs into the heart's health and overall health. I know you mentioned some traits that are traits of the heart. Can you talk about some of the other traits?
Yeah, the reason that I spend a good deal of time in the whole second part of the book is dedicated each chapter for one of these seven timeless traits of the heart is that, as you saw when I was trying to answer your question, I always get a little funny when someone says, give me one thing I can do, because I may be helping one person, but what about the other 100 people where that doesn't work for them? And what about the idea that it suggests that all I have to do is one thing and that'll set me down the right path? So for me, I found my own healing process a little more nuanced than that, took a little more work. So what I did was I asked myself, people use the metaphor of the heart all the time. They say, oh, he's so warm-hearted, she's so lighthearted, you're not open-hearted enough, these kinds of things. And I started interviewing. I interviewed 60 or so scientists from around the world and also yoga teachers and meditation experts and patients and doctors. And I interviewed everybody and I said, what traits and characteristics come to mind when you think about the heart? And so I wanted to explore what our language says, what our language and the way we use the heart as a metaphor says about the human condition. And I came up with seven traits that happened to be consistent for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. And you can look at any religious tradition, wisdom tradition, and they celebrate these traits. The first trait is steadiness. We alluded to that a minute ago, which is that simple step of dealing with stress. Like, you could write a whole book about dealing with stress, but that's just chapter number 6, is about how do we study the four dimensions of the heart, as I speak about in the book, the physical, the emotional, the social, and the spiritual heart. So before we can connect and be empathic and lead to a kinder world, we have to each do a little work to steady our hearts. The second of the traits is wisdom. We have to have some sense of wisdom, which means intuition, which means checking into our bodies, knowing right from wrong, what's going to be healthy choices, what's not going to be healthy choices, what's going to lead us towards happiness, and what's going to lead us away. We often get that wrong. So we have to develop wisdom. And then there, once we have wisdom and steadiness, we want to develop an openness of our hearts. We can't connect with others without that open-hearted quality, which now leads us to kind of the fourth trait, which is wholeheartedness. So wholeheartedness just means, number one, reconciling or reckoning with our past. We all carry this baggage from childhood. Some of us don't even know it. And when I'm meeting you, I'm actually talking to somebody in my past, and I'm projecting that onto you. Wholeheartedness also means putting our devices down. It means not giving you half of my heart. It means putting this away and being fully present with you throughout our interaction, feeling what you feel and communicating with you. And then once we can have that wholeheartedness, there's something that I was lacking, and many people pleasers lack, those of us who maybe were taught that our opinion didn't matter at some point. It's courage. I spent a good deal of time, a couple of months, researching the sources of courage and the science of courage and where it comes from and how to develop it. And so that's the coolest one, because the word courage itself, from the Latin cor, it means heart. Back to your question, the ancient Incas, the Mayans, they believed that courage was rooted in the heart. And I'm trying to show how it actually is in some way by this two-way flow of information from the heart and brain. And then after courage is lightness. I love lighthearted people, people who have a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face. And I was not that person for at least 15 years. And so I wanted to get that back. And this is where I go into the science of positive psychology, which really helps us live with lighter hearts. And in each chapter, I explain, not only do these traits help our emotional hearts, but the physical hearts as well. And there's about 350 scientific references at the end of the book where I show all the research on this. And then the final chapter, the final of the seven traits, is for me what the book is all about. And everything else you could throw out, but you can't get there without developing those. And that's having a warm heart. I want to live with a warm heart. I love being around people who are warm-hearted and kind. And so that chapter is about what gets in the way of our natural capacity for empathy, compassion, and love. And once we see those obstacles, how do we remove those obstacles, and how do we strengthen our natural abilities?
Jonathan, when somebody goes through these traits and does the practices to adopt these traits, the heart has an ability to communicate that. So if you build warmth in your heart, you can make me feel warmth. How does that connection between the heart work?
I love that. The heart has what I like to think about. There's at least two different dimensions or axes of the heart, what I call a vertical axis, which is your physical heart, as we've been discussing, is connected with your emotional, spiritual, and social heart. What you're talking about now, which is the really fun part that I can use to help my patients and help anyone that I'm with, is this other dimension of the heart, sort of the horizontal axis. Because of the way that you and I are wired, Sharon, over millions of years, and because of the central role of the vagus doesn't just connect the brain and the heart and the intestine. It also controls aspects of the face and of our expression and even of our ability to hear tiny changes in the pitch of someone else's voice. So what we're speaking about is this idea of emotional contagion. Emotional contagion was described in the 80s by sociologists, and it really is this thing that says, whether it's an organization or a family, anytime one person walks into the room, the emotions of the room can shift. Other people feel it in their bones without any words being said. Now, that's what's happening. You're asking, how does that happen? It begins with micro expressions that are often subconscious. So I may want to put on a, quote, good face when I'm with my team at work, but if I'm feeling hostile or cynical or frustrated, it's going to come out in ways that my teammates are wired to have a BS detector. And so immediately there can be a shift in their own bodies. On the other hand, if I practice steadying my own heart before any situation, it shows up in my face. If you measured my blood pressure and heart rate, there would be a slowing. There would be an increase in my heart rate variability, which is a sign of cardiovascular health. When I show up that way, there are nonverbal cues that everyone around me picks up on, and their body, their mind, their heart then go into this conversation within themselves. And there's research that shows that singers in a chorus can have a synchronization of their heart rate when they're breathing or singing in a certain way. And so it's just a fascinating area, Sharon, this all these unspoken, invisible cues. And bottom line, the reason this is important is that when I walk into the exam room and I'm with a patient, I am very careful to be aware of how I'm showing up in that moment. Because if I want to be a healer and help them heal, I need to help them regulate their nervous system for the healing to really happen. And then to show them how to do it.
I think it's so profound the way humans uniquely communicate. And I think it's just so powerful that the nuances of that communication and ways that, like you said, like everyone has a BS detector, it's like built in, and all the more reason to work on these traits in our own hearts, if not for yourself, for other people.
I want to add to one thing you just said there. You said, if not for yourself, then for other people. For those people who have any kind of a meditation or a mindfulness practice, there's this beautiful little thing that many people do at the end that I learned about, where, and you could do this after you go to the gym, or you could do it after you meditate. After you've done this beautiful thing for yourself, you pause and you say, may I dedicate this practice in service of all the people around me? And so I love how you brought that up, that it's, I'm not talking about self-help. Yeah, these are going to benefit ourselves. I'm really more interested in the collective and the fact that our hearts are all interconnected. If we each do this work, it amplifies by that social interaction.
Yeah, like you said, it's a very positive, virtuous cycle. So it's kind of beautiful. Jonathan, with the time you have left, is there anything you'd want to share with our audience that we haven't had a chance to touch on?
I would love to go back to the message that helped me the most, that I needed to hear and was kind of radical at the time. And it's something that I still am working on. And it was what my sister told me when I was struggling. And she said, it was in a text message, early text message back then. She said, just be kind to yourself. For those people who already are kind to themselves, you know what it's like. But for the rest of us who are so used to go, 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 achievement mindset, pushing ourselves harder and faster, not speaking up for ourselves when maybe we ought to. That's what being kind to yourself is. It's checking in. It's listening to what's most important. And it's speaking up for ourselves too, with courage and with vulnerability, but also with courage. So that's my parting message here, is for everyone to practice kindness towards yourselves and see if it doesn't spill over towards the way you judge or don't judge and treat other people.
Yeah, it's a beautiful legacy from your sister. So thank you for sharing that. Jonathan, so your book, Just One Heart, A Cardiologist's Guide to Healing, Health, and Happiness, can you tell people how to find it and where to find you and learn more about this?
Absolutely. If you Google Just One Heart book, you'll find it. Or if you go on Amazon, there's a Kindle version, and then the audiobook, which I'll be recording in a few weeks, will be coming out in a few months, and the paperback is going to be there as well. So just Google Just One Heart book, or if you want to find me, you can look up Happy Heart MD. It's all one word, Happy Heart MD.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate all that you shared.
Sharon, thank you for the invitation. And what a pleasure and what a great gift you're giving to everyone with the work that you're doing with this podcast.
Well, same with all the work that you're doing, Jonathan. Just amazing and very needed. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.